the Canadian Bitcoiners podcast is just two guys and maybe a guest or two discussing Bitcoin, Bitcoin equities, and the related macroeconomic space. It's not meant to be financial advice, so please, if you're doing any investing after listening to our program, do your own research, do your own due diligence, and understand that any money you invest can be lost. The show is meant for entertainment purposes only, and we hope you enjoy the program.
All right, we're coming to you live. We're coming live from Toronto, Canada. Here, we're doing a collab with Green Candle and CBP Media, but without Len. Sad Len can't be here, but we got Mark Yeftovich, El Jefe. The boss. Oh, we're doing it live now? All right, so we sound live. So, Mark, grab a
before
microphone.
Before we start, I want to give you guys something.
Hold up. Joey's giving us a gift.
CBP Media here, the fresh merch.
Oh, wow. we're getting some shirts. I'm getting a shirt. What size do I get?
You both get medium.
All right, good. I'm extra medium.
I didn't get that many mediums.
There we go. I appreciate it, buddy.
I meant to bring you guys down some bomb thrower t-shirts.
Oh, but, man. Mark, if only you lived close by and could return the favor tomorrow. Look at how good those look.
They look great. So a little background while we're doing this here. I asked Joey if I could use his stuff to interview Mark here while I'm in Toronto, and he just hijacked the whole thing. So, but we're here. This is going to go on the Macro Insights podcast. So check it out on the Green Candle channel as well. After this goes live here, I might put a little bit of extra, maybe edit Joey out a little bit. I don't know.
I can't hear the audio. It might be worth talking past the mic, not into the mic. So like this.
Yeah.
I think so. I haven't done a live one like this in a long time. Well, I'm pretty sure this is the key, talking past it and not into it.
You know, it's the effort that counts. So I think we'll be okay.
There are probably no viewers.
Yeah.
There might be. You're not talking into it for sure. This is the cardinal sin when you're talking into the you're talking to someone else while you're talking. The Karadza brothers famously give you this rundown before you do their show, talking to the fucking microphone, because if you don't, no one can hear you. We can't turn you up. And then they sit on the opposite. They sit kitty corner from you, so you have to turn to talk to them. And then they'll go talking to the mic.
Jesus
like, come
Christ.
On, set it up so it's like easy to do. Don't set it up the way that you know I want to turn to talk. Anyway, Brandon, continue, buddy.
All right. So yeah, So obviously, if you guys don't know, you guys know Joey. We're on his channel right now. But if you're on my channel, Joey, give a little rundown who you are.
CBP Canadian Bitcoiners Podcast. I'm emceeing the Canadian Bitcoin Conference. My co-host Len, good friend Len, will be there as well. Mark is a friend of the show. He's been a friend of the show for a long time. And you want to talk to Mark, but I'm going to be here too. About what? Macro?
Well, yeah, outlook? I mean, I'm in Canada
Should
here,
we
right?
Should Mark? Should
yeah,
introduce
yeah, Mark? Yeah. We'll introduce Mark in a second, but we'll give a little preview why I wanted to bring you guys on and talk to you about it. Obviously, I'm here in Toronto, right, for the Canadian Bitcoin Conference. You know, obviously, I want to get some Canadians run down here, but I've been in here since Wednesday. We're recording this on Friday. So I've gotten a little lay of the land of Toronto, I feel, not a whole bunch, but just, you know, kind of like, I guess, interacting downtown, just small observations here or there. But I want to get like more of a rundown of like the overall like macroeconomic state. Obviously, we just had this past week, Canada raised interest rates 25 basis points and the United States didn't. So there's kind of a little dichotomy there. So I kind of want to run it down. Mark sent me a nice little article too, a little bit before this. So we can go over that too. But yeah, Mark, why don't you, El Jefe over here, why don't you introduce yourself? And yeah, we'll start from there.
Hi, folks. Mark Yeftovich here. I run a IT company based out of Toronto called EasyDNS. We sponsor the Canadian Bitcoiners podcast. I run a blog called Bomb Thrower Media at bombthrower.com. And yeah, been involved in Bitcoin since 2013. Austrian School Economics, and my mind is just kind of going blank now because I didn't know we were doing this live.
High pressure.
I know.
Yeah, we're you know, pressure makes diamonds over here, Mark. So we're putting you in the pressure cooker to start off. But all right, let's start. I'll leave it broad for both you and Joey. I want to hear like your overall opinions of kind of where we're at in this economic cycle. You know, whether that this general school of thought is there's some sort of business cycle, you know, that goes up, goes down. you know, if you kind of go around financial Twitter, there's a school of thought that, you know, we're in a recession now or heading there. Or if you look at backwards looking data, we're not there yet, or we might not even get there just based on, you know, unemployment, all those kind of things. So I want to hear your overall opinion of, you know, the kind of the macroeconomic state right now to start off.
Like the Canadian side of things?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like it's all interconnected. So Canadian and United States.
I'll talk to you a bit about Canada, and I'll give you some, you know, boots on the ground reporting. My wife and I, this is breaking news, I didn't even say this on the CBP yet, we just bought a house earlier this week. And
well, so congratulations, buddy.
Thank you. So we're going through the process to sell our current place and move to this new place. And, you know, we've been looking for a house for some time now. And in Canada, I think infamously at this point, even internationally, we're sort of known for this real estate bubble's a generous term, but I'll use it here since that's what everyone calls it. And the number of dollars that are tied up in terms of, you know, retirement savings and overall wealth in the homes in Canada. And one of the things that the Bank of Canada has tried to do publicly facing at that is quell this insanity in the real estate market. And what I see instead, or what I saw instead, was inventory pretty low. People don't want to swap mortgages or renew at these higher rates. And so what that's done is create increased demand for the houses that are being sold. And so every place we went to see over the last few months was retirees, estate sales, in some cases deaths, and I think other forced sellers. I think about my own neighbor who I've spoken ill of in the past on the CBP. We had a much smaller audience, but I'll do it again now. You know, they need a new roof. Their backyard's in shambles, fences in shambles. The only laundry hookup in their place is next to a microwave in their kitchen. And they just sold their place. In my estimation, pure spec on my part, but in my estimation, that's a for sale, because all those things, especially a roof, is very expensive. And so you'd almost rather sell into a market with restricted inventory numbers than spend all that money on project work around your home, especially if you're not planning on staying there for 5, 6, 7 years, right? Maybe you're waiting for a lull. So, you know, as far as like the rate hike cycle in Canada, I mean, I'd like to hear Mark's thoughts, of course. I personally don't think the things that you need to see from a 5-point in 18-month hike cycle are happening. The bank can't be happy with what they're seeing now.
Yeah, I think you're right. Was it you or Len or somebody tweeted that graph about a week ago that actually kind of triggered me a little bit on Twitter, that just showed the divergence between the real estate market in Canada versus the US, and how in the US it's been elevated since the 70s, like how it sort of runs ahead of, I think it was real estate prices versus disposable income.
Yes.
It was a multiple of it. So in the States, I'm making these numbers up off the top of my head. Let's say it's gone from like on par in 1970 to like maybe 4x today or 10x today. In Canada, it went from the same starting point to like 55x today. Like, it's just completely not even in the same ballpark. Canadian real estate is just way overpriced, even compared to its US, you know, market. We compare everything to the American market up here. And with that rate hike cycle that went up, like, real estate prices aren't coming down. I mean, we're not in exactly the same boat in terms of where we are in our sort of life cycle of property ownership. But when COVID hit, even before COVID hit, we were looking for a cottage. Mm-hmm. We've always wanted a cottage. And it felt like, okay, things are a little crazy, but maybe things will cool off a bit. And then by the time COVID ended, like, cottage prices, the ones we were looking at, they quadrupled. It was crazy. Like, it's like we were looking at places that were, you know, call it under $1 million. And then suddenly by the end of COVID, it's like, why is every place we're even like looking at the listing $4 million?
To paint you a bit of a picture, Brandon, it feels like to me growing up, and Mark, I don't know if you're in the same boat, but it feels like to me even now and growing up, everyone I know either has a cottage or knows somebody with a cottage that we can go to every weekend in the summer if we want. Cottages are fairly common here because of all the lakefront property kind of out of, you know, off the beaten path, right? Canadians famously, I was laughing today when I was packing my car. You'll appreciate this, Mark. Every Canadian, I think, has one of those like folding camping chairs in their car at all times. Yeah. I had to get rid of the camping chair in my car today. I haven't been camping this year, but still in there from last year. Like, it's always there. That's how frequent cottaging is here. And so when Mark says he's looking for a place under $1 million, it's pretty reasonable. But after COVID, and actually, I don't know if you read, did you guys read the latest Arthur Hayes?
The exit.
No, I haven't.
There's one that came out, I think, 2 days ago or a day ago. Okay. I was reading it last night, and he makes a great, great distinction between the true, you know, top 1 or 5% of the wealth, and then what he calls the affluent or affluent. I never know how to say that word. Immediate like underclass of that top 1%, and he's basically saying that there's so many white collar folks who got support during COVID vis-a-vis either direct stimulus or vis-a-vis asset markets pumping from stimulus.
Or PPP loans too.
We don't have that here.
Oh yeah.
We don't have that here. And so when Mark says, like, when you say that the cottage prices went up, is there a better example of white collar people benefiting from asset pumping than those prices going up?
Yeah.
Those are everyone who sold all their whatever Nvidia and Meta during the, you know, that run up in 2020, 2021 and bought cottages. That's for sure what happened. For
Muskoka
sure what happened.
Lakefront property.
Yeah.
I saw we were renting a place every year. We go up and rent a place up in Port Carling. And I saw an ad in one of the real estate magazines up there that said, Muskoka Lakefront property is a hard asset like Bitcoin and gold.
You told me this, I think, actually. It's true. It is true.
Well, yeah. I got to ask you, let's back up here for a second, because we talked a little bit at the beginning about the interest rate hikes. Well, that affects y'all's real estate a little bit more than it does the United States, right? Because in the United States, you buy a house, majority of people that are buying a house that are listening here, 30-year fixed mortgage.
Yeah.
So I bought a house, COVID, September 2020. I locked in an interest rate of 2.75.
Really?
2.75. Okay. So I'm never fucking selling that thing. I mean, I'm letting it ride.
So that's
whatever.
A 30-year.
30-year, and it's never going to change.
No chance for...
The only thing that changes, though, which this is how they get you, like with the appreciation of the price of everything, is that every year they have like an appraiser kind of go around and look at the properties or whatever, and they say, this neighborhood's gone up by X amount of percentage, so that's how much your tax is going to go up.
We have
up.
The same thing here.
Yeah.
I mean, you guys are going to have the same thing, but that's how your payments... increase over time, basically, because like I mean, I don't know, most
so
people my age,
some of the value going up because there's an appraiser from the government that comes around.
Yeah,
here
but like, for example, my mortgage when I first bought the house was like just under or just around 2200. Mm-hmm. And then a year after owning the house, it's now 2400. Because like it went up to $200 a month. It doesn't sound like a lot, but that's
the
like
taxes onto your mortgage.
Yeah. It's like, okay. It's $2,400 a year, you know, $200. It's a decent chunk of change.
Over here, we have a different mechanism. I'm going to get this wrong, Mark. So correct me if I'm missing this. We have something called MPAC here, Municipal Property Assessment Commission, committee, something like that. And what they do is they look at the cost of homes on their market value metrics. I don't know what they are. They may be transparent. They may not be. I've never looked into it. But for sure, their market value is a lot lower than you could sell your house for.
Yeah. They're way off.
They're way off.
Well, so, do you know how they value like multifamily properties in the United States now?
How?
They basically send out a survey and they say, how much do you think you could rent this property?
Owner's equivalent rent,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah. And then they say that before. And that's how they value like, I mean, I have a duplex.
That goes into your inflation number, not the actual cost of homes, I believe, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
And then that's also like a rental affordability, like, you know, how much rent is going up. They do this all by survey. Okay. So, I mean, this is why I think like the whole macroeconomic state too, this kind of what I wanted it was almost like asking you guys kind of indirectly at the beginning was that, you know, when you look at a lot of these statistics, whether it's like the jobs report, rent increases, all that kind of thing, it's all survey data. And in the United States, I don't know about you guys, like I don't think any of my friends fill out any of these damn surveys. Like, you're not getting it via email or whatever. Even if you're getting via email, you're hitting that X send to the trash bin or whatever.
Right.
But I get those things. I don't fill them out or send them back. But, you know, the 30% of people that do, that's who kind of dictates the entire data set.
And that's the policy.
Yeah.
Policy gets set by that data.
That's 100%. And it's just like, I mean, and Jerome Powell's in front of people talking about these numbers,
right,
like the jobs report, all that stuff. And it's, you know, I've spoken to like Neely Taminga, who's like big on the Twitter spaces or whatever. So she always breaks down the JOLTS report and all these other jobs data. But it's insane. Like, you're not seeing the unemployment go to where you think it would be.
No.
And like, I, for one, can't believe that data is actually accurate any at any sort of it's probably not, right?
Self-reporting famously, whether it's how much you think your home would go for, or if you're into weightlifting, what's called RPE, right? How many reps you have left in the tank. You're just not a good judge of those things. You're always going to make mistakes when you're trying to guess what someone else would pay for something that you own. Famously, otherwise homes would not sell above and below asking price all the damn time.
Yeah, I mean, and you're gonna think you're a better athlete than you are. I mean, like, you think you're faster than I am. I mean, it's all that kind of stuff. It just all is intertwined here.
I think on a windy day, you might go backwards, honestly. So we'll talk about that another time. You know what else is interesting? Here, we have another data point. I don't know if it goes into any actual policymaking officially, but we have another thing here called union expected wages, or union expectation, wage expectation, something of that nature. You guys may have it as well. But if I look at, for example, the public service here, the National Public Service just received a 4-year deal worth, I think, a total of 12.7%. Three of those years have already elapsed. So if you work for the federal public service, you're about to get a 9% raise in like 6 months or something like that.
Well, doesn't Canada have like a very high percentage of tons. The like 60%?
So in the national public service,
it's like, I think it's like 20 something. Last time I tried to look.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So and public service, I exaggerated by public quite service a bit
means,
then, huh?
Public service means a lot of things, teachers, police. Yeah.
Okay. However, for the last, like, since COVID, especially, the lion's share, and maybe that's the number you're thinking of new job creation is in the public sector.
Okay.
So I actually think I may have, I don't know, maybe that's a cognitive bias, but I thought I might have heard something like 60% of new jobs created since COVID were public sector.
That's probably where I got that number.
We talked about that on our show a while ago. I don't remember the number, but it was during COVID. And yeah, it's crazy, Brandon. So to give you an idea, when, you know, our finance minister was on stage, addressing our Congress, I don't know, 3 weeks ago, something like that, talking about how the jobs market is strong and the GDP number is strong. There's a lot of good economists. I think about Rich Diaz a lot, who does a show called The Looney Hour. And he always points out that the per capita GDP in Canada has been basically stuck for, you just pull it toward you, Mark. Has been basically stuck for the last 10 years. So all these jobs that we're creating, all these, you know, quote unquote, new opportunities the Canadians have been presented with since COVID, many of them in the public sector, they're not actually translating to more production. We're bringing in a lot of immigrants. I think we just had the highest quarter on record, right?
That was like the highest, the most in a year, right?
Last year, we just crossed 40 million population today, or yesterday. Yeah. So that's, you know, to give you an idea of what that means, you know, we were 30 million, I want to say 15 years ago, something like that. And, you know, Canada, and the Americans know this better than most, I think. Canada parades around about, you know, talking about the sort of, I don't want to call it like a socialist paradise, but I think some people probably would. Everything is free, healthcare, education is cheap, blah, blah, blah. But you can't really get seen at a hospital. There's been no infrastructure build out to match that growth. And so we're seeing now some of the problems, and they're not just problems in hospital waiting rooms. I think they're problems in communities too. I think a lot of people are upset with the way things are going. For example, if you're, you know, a young Canadian, you've been here for 20 years, 22 years, 24 years, whatever, you're coming out of school, you have a pretty good degree. Famously in Toronto, if you have the average wage of someone who works in Toronto, I think you have to save, Len said this last week, you have to save for 21 years to be able to put a down payment down on a house in Toronto.
Yeah. Well, that's like if it doesn't inflate any more than
that's
it is.
Right. Yeah. Right, exactly. Yeah.
I mean, which, and you just said it's like in a bubble. So, I mean, hopefully it doesn't, I don't know. I don't know if it's better if it crashes or it doesn't at this point, but yeah, I mean, it just seems like it's definitely an interesting kind of, I don't know. There's like a lot of different differences between here and the United States just from being here for a week. I mean, we were just talking a little bit about this pre-show, like the sales tax is just insane. And like, you know, we're sitting here drinking a couple beers or whatever. To find beer is like ridiculous. I had to go walk in. You can only find it at a liquor store, but it was like 13% sales tax maybe,
yeah,
or something like that. Crazy. And then, but there's also like a cannabis store on every corner.
I believe
so you could find weed a lot easier than you can find alcohol.
I believe there is an additional tax on liquor products.
Yeah, built in.
Is it already in place or is it coming?
Probably both.
always when it comes to taxes. But it's already there. Is it coming? Both.
It's funny because like I would walk we're in like downtown Toronto, so you know there's a lot of like restaurants and everything like that. They'll say $6 beers and then tiny plus tax.
Yeah.
They're writing it on the signs to try to bring you in saying like, hey, we only got $6 beers. Well, I mean, it's like $8 really.
Canadians, this is really the difference between like an American or a tourist and us. When Mark and I see $6 for anything, whether it's a bunch of toilet paper, a beer or an SD card, I know that that's not the price.
Mm-hmm.
I know that. And a lot of people in Canada know that. It's instinctual at this point, but you're right. It can be a shock to people coming here for sure.
Well, yeah. I mean, it's a shock to me. I mean, when they say $6 or $5.99 or whatever, you know, I get that's implied like $6.50, $6.75 or whatever it is. Like, I'm not expecting like, you know, it to be exactly that, but I don't know. I just like it. It struck me once because I went like one of the first nights I was here, I went with a couple buddies to go grab some beers and it was like five beers and it was like $70 and like it was like paid like $15 worth of tax
plus tip.
Yeah, and then they of course everywhere now. I mean it's worse in the United States, I think, because in the United States minimum tip that most of these places have you offer now is at least 15%, I want to say. Here is at least like they give you like the 10, 12, 15, where in the United States it's like 15, 20, 25 or 20.
I haven't seen 10 on a machine in a year.
I saw 10 on a machine when I was out there buying. I think like today when I bought lunch or whatever.
I see 20 in restaurants.
Yeah.
My barber, like hairdresser, has up to 30.
Yeah.
And,
yeah, I always tip my barber a little bit more though, as long as he does a good job. So
I always just hit the top tier. Just that's how reflex is. Just like it's horrible.
Yeah,
it's horrible. And it's just like, you know, just
for the services, spread it as much as possible for sure. What do you make of the way that the Bank of Canada paused and then resumed a rate hike regime?
That surprised me. I mean, they're rudderless. They don't know what they're doing. They like it's clown show, comedy hour, amateur hour. That's the word I was looking for. It's like there's this expression and I just couldn't quite hit it.
Well, why? I mean, when what's his face? Our Jerome Powell, Tiff Macklem, the guy's name is.
Okay.
Far less charismatic. And in my opinion, far less likable. Like at least
Jerome
Powell.
How do you get less charismatic than Jerome Powell?
Jerome was at a Grateful Dead show 2 weeks ago. Did you see that?
No. Yeah, I did see that.
Someone took a picture of blurry Jerome Powell cruising at a Grateful Dead. He's a deadhead. Like that's cool. That counts for something. You know, like,
you know, but it's like,
it's fine. He's crashing the economy, but at least he's going to see the dead like on a Tuesday night. That's what I'd be doing.
Yeah, he's stimulating the economy, dude. How much were those concert tickets? Come on, man. But it's a consumer economy out there.
So over here, we just had, obviously, our rate hike cycle stopped in January, I think was the last hike, and then restarted again this week, like you said, Brandon, and shocked a lot of people, I think. There's a lot of mortgage and real estate people I follow who are shocked by that. And just more broadly, like I think, if, you know, the people in your circle, the Green Candle circle, probably are like, what the fuck is going on? Like Mark said, they're rudderless. They don't know what they should be doing.
Well, it seems like too, like, I don't know, we were kind of talking in our group chat or whatever that, you know, Canada is always like a little, like what they do, the US not follows, but it's kind of like they're the precursor for the United States, which is kind of interesting.
Mark has something to say.
Yeah, let's hear that. Well, let's hear
not
that.
Not me, actually. It's Foss often says that Canada is like the test run.
That's right.
for US policy, right? So I don't mean to jump south of the border. I personally don't think the Fed is going to hike again after this. I really think this is the beginning of like Fed pivot. Maybe I'm reading it completely wrong. Is Canada really like a test run for a pause and then raise, and then the US is going to do it one entire cycle behind? I really don't know. But here it's like, it is a sense of like Canada's like, let's try it out here, where there's zero consequences and the market is like less than the size of Texas and see what happens. I don't know if Canada really is on speed dial from US policymakers to that extent, but sometimes it feels that way.
But I mean, we were talking in our group chat, like if you looked right after the US hiked the percent chance, I don't know, on based on like what the market says, what Bloomberg Terminal.
The bond market. They're looking at the bond market.
Yeah, I know. But I'm just, you know, I'm throwing shade or whatever. But based on that, they said there's a 70% chance now that the United States hikes 25 basis points at the next meeting, according to our buddy SB.
Shout out SB. Like, I'd be curious to hear what Mark thinks. I'm personally looking more at what I see in terms of like the political ramifications. You're about to hit, and this is not the next hike, obviously, but if I look at the dot plot, I see Powell saying that they're going to go higher for longer. They're committed, but I also see that they're looking at a point and a half lower, a point 1.25 points lower at the end of 24. That's election promises and stuff like that. To me, it's hard. It's a lot harder to lower faster than it is to raise fast. Because you had a kind of a reason here, right? Everyone talks about this is the fastest hiking cycle we've ever seen. So in my opinion, and I'm not, you know, I'm not at all, you know, trained or qualified to make this assumption, but just looking at the way that this was received, it seems to me fair to say that people would be more upset with the hikes and the pain if the decrease was as swift and as sudden. And so I expect them to cut 25 points. If they got to get five cuts in, like the bond market is pricing, they have what, 16 months to do it. That's one cut about every three meetings. So to me, it's hard. Like Mark said, you know, how are they going to raise again in a month or in 2 months? What is the plan there?
Well, I mean, Powell even said, like,
he says a lot of stuff. That's his job. His only policy tool is jawboning. He doesn't have another tool. That's why the Fed, like, you can turn on your TV and see a Fed speaker more than you see The View. You realize that?
Yeah,
you
know, I understand, but I'm just saying, like, he said higher for longer. He said that like during this meeting that they, you know, essentially said that there was no talk of a rate hike prior to Q1 of 24. So I mean, like,
say we're going to cut next meeting, buy stocks.
No, I understand that, but I'm just saying, like, you don't think that there's some sort of delusion in the stock market? I mean, you've been calling for a pivot for the past like 3 months.
I have been.
So yeah. I mean, like, I just think, like, to me, he's been saying higher for longer. They're looking at the job numbers, which we've already gone over like earlier in this talk, that the job numbers are full of shit. They're not very reliable data.
They're often revised, right, as well.
Yeah, they're revised like later on, and they're looking at all this like backward looking data. They're going to look at CPI, which prints about the month before, and they're not going to look at anything forward. So in my opinion, they're going to keep it higher for longer, and that it's because they're going to fuck up and keep the rates too high too long. You know what I'm saying? Like, I mean, that's why I think
mistake is going to be on the other side of the coin.
Yeah, I think that they're going to keep raising and keep raising, and then they're going to be like, oh shit, now the economy's kind of crashing, now it's time to pull back.
Do you think we made that mistake
just now with this raise?
You think?
See, I was thinking, you got to look at what are the credit markets doing. I mean, that's what caused them. I don't think they looked at south of the border. I don't think they looked at CPI. I don't think they looked at jobs. I don't think they looked at any of that. I think they looked at it. We almost blew up the banking system. We have to pause.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, I mean,
maybe we'll try it again and then that's too late. But Canada, they didn't really have that. Sorry, I cut you off. They didn't really have that issue in Canada where we almost blew up the banking system, I don't think. But you know, how do you let the air out of a bubble like the Canadian real estate bubble, right? I've been waiting for that thing to crash for 30 years.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Maybe not 30, maybe 25. And, that graph going back that we talked about, like how far ahead of disposable income it is in Canada versus the States, you know, maybe they're going to try it. And I don't know. Like, I think it is a mistake to keep going, but I don't know how it's going to manifest in Canada versus like the regional bank crisis that set off in the States.
Well, I mean, the banking system in Canada is a lot different than the banking system in the United States, right? I mean, like, you guys have, what is it, four major players?
Six or something. Maybe.
Okay, six.
I think National Bank of Canada is the sixth largest. I can't name the ones underneath that.
Okay. Well, yeah, I mean, in the United States, I mean, like, the banking crisis, like, the way that I think that, you know, I talked to a lot of the financial guys, right? I mean, and the way that they kind of look at it is like, you know, Silicon Valley Bank was extremely poorly managed. They were investing in a lot of growth kind of, you know, I don't know, like crypto companies to like all these kind of like volatile companies.
They're looking for 100x's, right?
Yeah, they were looking for a ton of returns on their stuff. Like, I mean, there's if you look at the, like the banking system in the United States, the amount of regional banks has decreased every year since I think like 90, maybe even in the 80s, and it's gone down every single year. And so people don't really notice it, but the big four guys in the United States have been swallowing up all the regional banks. And that's just kind of, you know, par for the course. And that's like what I think is going to happen eventually in the long term, is that there's going to be four big dogs and the United States is not going to be this like, I mean, that's what I fear the most, is that United States is not going to be the small business kind of area that it's been for all these, like, you know, promoting entrepreneurship and all this kind of stuff. And that's kind of the way we're going, is that we're going to get swallowed. These regional banks are going to get swallowed up by the big dogs. Mom and pop shops are done for, and you know, people are going to go find incentives somewhere else. I mean, we're seeing it, the writing on the wall kind of the United States now, right? I mean, they're saying that there's the dollar for the global reserve currency is going down. Yeah. Janet Yellen said it's going to be a slow change. I mean, like, they're already kind of preparing the United States for like, hey, buckle up, we're not going to be the world power anymore. And that, like, kind of, in my opinion, trickles over to Canada as well. Because you guys are like, you know, obviously the close proximity and everything like that. So, I mean, I don't know. I kind of just went on a little tangent there.
We can defend, you might know more about this than me, Mark. Can we not defend our dollar competently because of the energy we have?
We don't want to defend our dollar.
Tell me why.
Because we want to be able to export our goods.
Okay.
Right? We don't like a strong dollar up here. Strong dollar is bad. So we have to talk like we want to defend our dollar, but we have to actually like keep it lower. Canadians don't like the dollar at par. They certainly don't like the dollar being above par.
Isn't there something to be said about how an aging demographic needs a strong dollar to buy imported goods because we're not producing anymore? Aren't we going down that road? Don't we need that dollar to be strong to buy goods from other places because we're not making them?
Joey, those are old people.
Well, aren't there going to be more of them than, I mean, there's more of them than anyone else.
It's like the politicians and the people calling the shots, they're not going to care.
No.
I don't think so.
Yeah, I don't think they give a shit.
Especially if older people like vote conservative.
Yeah. 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 No, that's true. That's a good point. In Canada, we're a lot of the different beast, right? We got also the provinces. There's such a disparity, I should say, between the provinces and how much GDP they bring to the table. Famously, I think Dave Bradley, who's going to be at the conference this weekend, told me that Alberta pays for something like 60% of the Quebec entitlements, healthcare, education, retirement. Yeah. Like insane.
I don't see any scenario where Alberta is still in the Confederation in like 20 years.
I don't even think it's going to be that long.
Yeah.
Danielle Smith has a lot of tailwind, I think. Yeah. There's a lot of Albertans who are tired of what they see. The last 2 years have been eye-opening, to say the least, for a lot of them, and I don't blame them.
Yeah, and Ottawa's not really trying to build bridges to them.
No.
I mean, it's unbelievable. It's unbelievable the way, what's the word I'm looking for? The imperiousness of the Ottawa government, the way they're treating Alberta especially.
Yeah.
And it's like, you've got to be kidding me. And then everyone's going to act all surprised when Wexit happens.
I know. Alberta has a strong but not overpriced real estate market. Alberta has all our natural resources, not all our natural resources, but all our energy resources, basically.
Yeah, they're the energy powerhouse.
What kind of like energy resources, like oil, gas, oil, like energy, hydro, oil, and gas?
Famously at the CFL championship game, the Grey Cup, years ago, the premier, Jason Kenney. You know, every Canadian watches the Grey Cup. It's a big deal here. Yeah.
Chad Kelly, Grey Cup MVP.
That's right.
Shout out Swag.
South Park did a great episode where I think they crashed the Grey Cup and the game was the Canada Rough Riders versus the Canada Rough Riders. Unbelievable, right? Because there is two teams. There's always two teams in the league called the Rough Riders. It's so dumb. It's
like, how does that only in Canada?
It's amazing.
But it's
so Kenny quirky. He's at the game doing the coin flip and he's got this shirt on that says, I heart oil and gas. And Twitter that night was livid. You can imagine. I can't believe this guy. He's, you know, supporting fossil fuels. This is not good for the country, the economy, this is like, without going down this rabbit hole about climate change and all that, there's something to say there for sure. But explain to me again, this is the case for a lot of things, whether it's economics or energy or whatever. You have to have a better idea. What is it? And I don't hear one from anybody. Intermittents don't work. And Canada has been trying to go down this road with green. And famously, we've had these negotiations with European leaders about exporting LNG.
Nuclear is off the table.
It's off the table. Even though CANDU reactors are famous around the world. We're the only people that do this right.
Yeah.
And we don't want to build them. We refuse to build them. I don't know why. I don't know why.
How about some windmills instead?
Instead. Yeah, exactly.
Well, I mean, I think over 90% of energy now in the United, not even in the United States, I want to say, or maybe even globally, is like all powered by oil and gas.
Yeah.
At this point.
I believe it.
And so, I mean, it's like, all right, if 90, I don't know, how are you going to change completely 90%? And like, we have states like California, probably similar-ish policies, I would say, to Canada.
The left-leaning state, right?
Yeah. Where they, you know, they've said that they're outlawing selling oil and gas vehicles by like 2035.
Yeah, the internal combustion engines no longer allowed to be sold.
So have you ever heard Doomberg's take on Ontario, right? So,
I've heard in the past. But
like Ontario, in his mind, and I think he's right, says Ontario is an example of a locality or a jurisdiction that has successfully decarbonized.
Mm-hmm.
So Ontario has done it. We pulled it off in like 1980.
Yeah.
Since 1980, 65% of the electrical power comes from nuclear, right? The rest comes from like hydro, natural gas. There's no coal.
No.
It's a thing of the past. And like maybe a tiny, tiny sliver of oil generation. He says, you guys have done it. And now you guys want to undo it because you don't want to replace your Pickering nuclear plant and you want to like, let's, you know, power down.
Yeah.
And it's just absolutely ridiculous. And if I could remember the name of the guy that he talks about a lot,
Chris Kiefer.
Yes.
Yeah.
Who's trying to, you know, bring some sanity to the nuclear conversation here.
It's just all lobbying, dude. I feel like at this point, like you just have to follow the incentives of the politicians.
This is always making the case, these. Right?
I mean, you just follow the dollar trail, and that's why you figure out why the green energy policies are running through and all. It's just insanity to me. It doesn't make any sense.
No.
But then it's like, and then you sell it to the public, like to try to make them feel good. So it's like an emotional response.
Or you give them
tax credits.
Exactly.
Yeah, you give them tax credits and they make them feel good. You're like, hey, there's more money in my pocket and I'm doing good for the world.
That's right.
I mean,
those things are wrong, by the way, right?
Yeah, I know. Exactly.
Yeah, over here we have this thing called the Parliamentary Budget Office. It's an arm's length, you know, sort of reviewer of all things federal budget. And the PBO puts out a report every year and the report says the same thing every year. You're not getting money back. No matter how many dollars you get in rebates, you're still paying more in taxes, man. Like, these, again, like, I hate to say it, but it seems to me like there's a lot of left curve, you know, on the bell curve types who vote all of a sudden and they got nothing better to do but vote and tweet. And this is what policies, you know, the fulcrum for major policies is that loud group of people who don't know any better and think that they're getting rebates, think that they're doing something right, think that they're helping, but to your point, you know, there's a famous quote. You should put this in the easy access of easy mark. I haven't seen this one yet. The answer to all of your questions is money.
Yeah.
No matter what the question is, the answer at some base level is money. It's always going to be money.
And 100%.
Politics has become that in most of the modern world. The problem is for politicians in the past, there was no vehicle for the average person. There's no podcast back then. Three guys shooting the shit in the hotel room about this stuff, sharing it with people. Like the chat is full of people. This is like, you know, if you tried to do this 10 years ago, you couldn't do it. You couldn't do it. And now the vehicles and the speed, the velocity of information sharing makes it very difficult to spread this nonsense. And so what do we see instead, right? This is a tangent on my part, but instead you see silencing. This person is anti-science. They're a denier. Denier of what? I'm not saying climate change isn't happening. I'm saying nuclear is the answer. The answer can't continue to be me giving you more money and not asking what I'm getting for it. But this is what we're expected to do. We got to stop. This is why Bitcoin is so important. Outside money, right? I don't want to give you any of that. Good luck. You can print your way into whatever you want, but I'm not going to participate at some level anymore, right? That's the answer.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. For me too, I think like a lot of people our age, Joey, and maybe even younger than us, like think that, you know, paying that they're raised in this education system that says like, all right, the government's kind of there to help you out, right? Yeah. But I mean, if you look at everything, like we kind of lined it out at the beginning, you know, you say free healthcare. It's not free. Like, I mean, like I've gotten into this.
It's not free and it's not healthcare.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly.
Just in case you weren't sure.
Yeah. I mean, like I was talking to somebody earlier, like I pay probably, I don't know, I would say like 30% of my salary in taxes.
Yeah.
You guys probably pay closer to 50. And
all said
53 is the top. 53 is the top. Bracket.
That's
yeah.
For income. And then, you know, like we were talking about earlier, I mean, I don't want to go through the number, but I'll tell you, it's a lot higher than fucking 30 or 50 or whatever your nominal tax bracket is. It's a lot.
Well, yeah. I mean, we went through the sales taxes higher, like all these different vehicles that you guys are getting taxed way more. And then, you know, I mean, just anecdotally, you're talking about like medical care. I ran track in Memphis. I've gone over this a couple times, but there's a big connection to our women's soccer team to Canada. All of them, you know, soccer, you tear your ACL pretty frequently.
Yeah, sure.
All of them always said, yeah, after I tore my ACL, I would come down to the States to get the surgery because I would have to wait 3-4 months with a torn ACL. Then that's extra training time. And then, you know, you lose a scholarship, yep. You lose whatever, like you don't get to play in college. Your career is set back for all that kind of stuff. So, I mean, like, it's just like little things like that. It's like people don't really realize, okay, like, you know, it's maybe all good and plenty, but like in reality, are you really paying 20% of your salary in the United States to healthcare every single year? Majority of people are getting it paid through their company that they work for, and they pay $100 a paycheck, whatever, mm-hmm. you know, like very small amounts. And then, you know, if you want dental, you could opt in, you could opt out, like all these other like vehicles. And it's really not as expensive as people try to make it out to be. The only time it's expensive, something detrimental happens, which, okay, like if something detrimental happened and you were in Canada, you'd have to wait 3-4 months. You know what I'm saying? So I like people make this big deal in the United States and like Canadians that like the differences in the healthcare, it's such a big drastic thing. But I think, you know, that the inefficiencies in government just really show through and shine through when it comes to like the healthcare system.
Where do you think rich Canadians go for healthcare?
Yeah, I know they go to the United States
or elsewhere.
Mexico,
Cuba, anywhere and get like these run of the mill surgeries, ACL, hip, knee, you know, whatever.
Where they're like standardized basically everywhere.
There's places that do this stuff on a, you know, damn near a production line at this point. It's not a mystery, right? That medical information has been shared the world over. You can go to any doctor. It doesn't matter what language they speak. If they got a sterile room and the right tools, they'll do a good job.
Yeah.
And, you know, if you're someone looking to get a knee replacement, for example, popular surgery in Canada, you turn 70 years old, whatever, you get a knee replaced or a hip replaced or whatever.
Or even a shoulder too. My dad's about to get his shoulder replaced.
And so like you get this stuff done. It's almost outpatient surgery at this point. You're there a day, maybe 2 days after the surgery, and then you're gone. And in Canada, you know, there's a lot of problems. I saw a buddy today, a friend of mine who works a physical job. He's in construction. I think he's like a site, you know, super or whatever, but he's had a hernia for like 3 months. He's got to wait another 2 months to get the surgery because his job's not physical enough, you know? So, you know, the government decides what percentage of the time you're allowed to push paper in order to get surgery to improve your quality of life. Do you think in the meantime, they lower the taxes you pay toward healthcare?
They could offer a maid.
Yeah. Have you considered suicide, sir?
The other third rail in Canadian politics is private healthcare.
Yeah.
Like, why can't there be a two-tier system?
Billboards everywhere in Ontario now, which you've seen, I'm sure.
I mean, in Europe, where, you know, that's the other socialist paradise where people say, well, we want healthcare to be free, like in Canada or Europe, but Europe has private health tiers.
Yeah.
You can actually, it's got the government National Health Service, but there are private practitioners. And here in Canada, I mean, well, if there isn't one, then you just have the medical tourism. They just leave the country. But it makes so much sense because you could still have a system where no one, like, I do think I see what happens in the States sometimes. And I hear like, oh, so-and-so is doing a crowdfunder because they got sick. And I'm like, there just seems something wrong mm-hmm. about not being able to afford to get sick or have an accident. So there's got to be this sort of happy medium where, yeah, you've got a public healthcare system. Everyone's got a social safety net. No one's going to like die because they can't afford medical care. But for the people who have the resources, well, for one thing, you're taking stress off the public system. Two, you could tell all the doctors to say, okay, you have to put in a certain amount of time on the public system, and you can sort of start using like layering into the private system as you sort of build up
points in the public system.
Sure.
Things like that could actually work. And then you'd have a system where, like to me, it's like spending more money on your own healthcare should be as simple as, well, I want to eat organic and organic food is more expensive, but I just, it's just a choice I make. So I don't have a flat screen TV, but I eat organic or something like that. So something you should be able to decide to do or work towards or put in the, like, okay, I want to be able to afford to do this. So I'm going to figure out a way to do it. Whereas no, it's like food is free, but everybody's got to eat at McDonald's. This is Canada.
Yeah.
That's the way. But Mark, that sounds logical.
That's another third rail type thing in Canada's logic with these policies, it seems like, unfortunately.
But I mean, you know, we can get down the food rabbit hole too, but I mean, it's like in the United States, everybody's addicted to some sort of pharmaceutical drug too. I mean, like big pharma. Sure. Even though we pay for our healthcare and it's, you know, people come in for major surgeries, there's also a bad incentive in that sense. You know, I mean, everybody's addicted to Adderall. There was like an Adderall shortage, like, I don't know, a few months ago. And there's jokes going around Twitter saying that Wall Street's going to crash because there's not enough Adderall for all these, I guess a decent sized group of friends, and I would probably say like 2/3 of them probably take Adderall like on a daily basis. And that's, you know, it's like, it's ridiculous. And you'll see them like freak out. And then I had one friend who got in a car accident and she was drinking a coffee and she had an Adderall and they're like, oh my God, like, are you okay? Your heart rate is like well over 100. She's like, oh, like, I'm a little shocked. And they're like, well, you shouldn't be this shocked. She's like, oh, I just took an Adderall and drank a coffee. And they're like, oh, it's okay. They like rubbed it off like it's nothing. I'm like, are you kidding me? Like, this should not be okay. Yourself, like, you shouldn't be able to, I don't know.
Ask yourself this. This is not exactly macro, but, you know, I often think about the societal consequences of these difficult job markets, housing markets, difficult economic times. What incentive do you have as a 17-year-old? Let's say you're coming out of high school. Okay. Easy to get into the university in Canada, probably easy in the States too. Let's say you get into a university and all your peers, when you get to first year, are on Adderalls and you're watching as you're starting to get drowsy at 9 o'clock, trying to keep up with your studies or keep up partying or whatever. And all your buddies are like good to go till 2-3 in the morning. They sleep for 4 or 5 hours. They have a coffee and Adderall in the morning because they got a prescription and they're rolling the whole day. What incentive do you have as someone who's young, impressionable, which are, you know, difficult things to overcome in the best of times, but also realizing that the, you know, the light at the end of the tunnel is not quite as bright as it was 20 years ago. What incentive do you have to stay off of that stuff?
Jesus,
it's so
Joey,
hard.
My daughter's 17. You're freaking me.
It's so hard, man. It's so hard. And we, you know, Brandon and I are, I think, a few years apart, but this was never something that was on the table when I was in school.
Well, okay.
Nobody,
so for me, at,
how old are you? Are you?
I'm
20.
I'm 28.
So
I'm going to be
way younger.
I'm going to be 29 later this month. So everybody, be sure to wish me happy birthday, July 23rd. Sure. When I was in school, Adderall was kind of like a new thing. So like, I had one teammate on my track team who was on Adderall, and I saw him once, like, I'm not going to dox his name or anything, but I saw him once, like, he forgot his little pill bottle before we went to a track meet. He was throwing up the day before. Man. And I'm like, dude, buddy, like, you got to look in the mirror. Like,
withdrawals,
this is,
man, for sure.
Yeah. And he wasn't even like, I mean, compared to what I like his prescription level compared to what I know of people taking right now was nothing. Like, it was like 5 milligrams or whatever. I know people taking 15 a day, and imagine, like, I mean, man. It's just insane. And so people are all hyped up and, you know, but hey, Big Pharma's here to help us. So, I mean,
it's incredible. It's really disturbing to see what's going on that front. And then, you know, on top of that, that joke about the financial district, you know, falling apart if there's an Adderall shortage. I mean, there's a lot of Instagram accounts with a lot of likes about guys on Bay Street here in Toronto, just doing coke all day. And
yeah,
you know, whether that's true or false doesn't really matter. The general point stands that personality is the only type that can be successful. That sort of, like, you know, always on the go, always on 100, always on. And so kids, they see that stuff and it's hard to get out of that mode. And worse, man, like, you know, not to freak you out, Mark, I know your daughter's going to university, you know, next year, but the thing that I think bothers me the most, having worked with young people over the last 5 or 6 years and, you know, also doing some work in addiction services, once you start, the dependency is very difficult to get off of. We often in our society talk about things like the sugar salt dependency cycle. Everyone knows about this, how it's intentional by food manufacturers to get you hooked, right? You can very, very infrequently buy a children's cereal that doesn't have a little bit of salt and sugar kick in the same box to just keep you coming back. But no one talks about the number of kids under 10 who are prescribed Adderall because, surprise, there's an incompetent teacher at the front of the classroom and the kid would rather play Xbox than learn his multiplication tables. What a fucking shock. So what are we going to do? We're going to medicate the young man? Come on.
Is it, am I naive, or is my impression correct that that whole drug permaculture is noticeably absent from the orange laser-eyed, from the Bitcoin community?
I think it's absent. And I'll be the first.
I disagree.
I'll be the first.
I mean, I think there's a lot of drinking and partying. And
when I was younger, I used to take like Molly, you know, to party here and there. But you know, the older you get, the more established you become, the more time you spend learning about things like longer time horizons and stuff like that.
That's baked into the culture, so you start to think, well, if I'm taking this shit every day, that's kind of a short-term time frame, and I'm going to hit this point of diminishing returns. It's like fiat.
For sure.
It's like, yeah, I can print $1 trillion today, and I can print $1 trillion tomorrow, but after a while, it's going to start to like not be so hot.
The kick is not going to be the same.
So if you get it, if you understand Bitcoin, you start to get that sort of longer-term.
I think that's the case.
Here's why I disagree.
You go to more meetups than either of us.
Yeah.
Yeah. You guys are older than me. So I think like kids, like people like around my age, I guess, like see the volatility. They still are stressed out with things. So they go out and they blow off some steam. And so, you know, like we were kind of talking about like the memes with like, you know, I guess Coke and Adderall and all that kind of stuff. But, you know, why do you think that those people that are, you know, I guess joking about it, why, like in higher up positions, why do you think that they're doing that? Because they have a very stressful job or a very stressful life or whatever. Like, I mean, you know, some people in the Bitcoin space, I would say like the longer you're in it, probably the less likely you're going to do it,
for sure,
do those kind of things. But there's also still like, I mean, the culture around
the whole,
I guess,
conference circuit and stuff like that.
Yeah, the conference circuit. I mean, it depends which one you go to, right? I mean, if you go to Miami, that conference all about partying, right?
How was,
I mean,
that? Would you say that there was extracurriculars there? A lot? More than you thought?
I mean, dude.
I don't want you to rat people out.
No, I mean, I love Miami. I love Miami. I go, look, I don't really do any of that. I like to drink. And so I like to go out to hit the bars and paint the town red and do all that kind of stuff. But I don't like the extracurriculars in that kind of sense. So, but it's there. You know what I'm saying? Like, I'm not like, I'm 28 years old. I live guess. In.
Yeah. They did make a movie about that, right?
I mean, I'm 28 years old and I live in Florida. You know what I'm saying? So like, if you go to any bathroom,
but is the question like, but in Mark's a bar, question, it's like, Mark's question still stands, right?
Yeah. Or I mean, I think
on Twitter, if you were to believe the personas of the average NIM Bitcoiner, it's traditional family. It even goes as far as like traditional gender roles, I think, in a lot of cases. You know, finance is a mess. We got to opt out. It's this idea of like the return to tradition as opposed to this.
It's
embrace
a bit of a
modernity.
Traditionalist mentality.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know, but I would think that the people that are into Bitcoin, maybe around my age or younger, would not be those kind of people anyway, if that makes sense.
Okay. Okay,
because like I think that the people
you're a Gen
that,
Xer, right, or a Gen
no,
Z?
No, I'm a millennial, bro.
Are you?
Yeah, I'm the last year of millennial. All right, don't slander my name. Actually, I don't know. I don't even know what a slander is anymore.
I'm looking forward to seeing what people are like this weekend. Honestly, I think there's a lot of good Bitcoiners here that I expect to be true to their word and their online. Persona is the wrong word.
Well, I think
they're online
avatars, basically.
I guess. Yeah. Is that it?
Well, I think what's interesting here is that there's going to be 250 or maybe 350 people. So it's a little bit more intimate. You get to talk to a lot more people. You get to network. I've already met like 4 or 5 people and like had dinner with them and done all that kind of stuff. And I didn't really I made an effort, I guess I would say, but I was also just kind of like posting my videos and people reached out to me. Whereas in Miami, you have to be a lot more conscious of like, hey, I'm going to buy a ticket to go to this party. to go to meet up with this person. Right. So that's why, I mean, like, if we're going to go, like, I guess, say go to other type of conferences outside of Miami, that's why I would say do that. If you're willing to spend the money and go to these big things, you're going to be able to get exposed to a lot more people. Depends how social you are, whatever. But in these like smaller intimate ones, you're going to get to know a lot more people or a lot of people a lot better. And then, you know, like maybe more opportunities can come out, but it really depends. Like, I guess where you put yourself. That's why I always believe that.
So why don't we, it's getting close to six. Why don't we wrap? I mean, it's your show, but I would.
Yeah. We've been rolling for a while.
Maybe just say like, what do you want to get out of the weekend? Like you've been asking other people that on your Twitter page. What do you want to get out of the weekend? You're here. Mark and I are local. Like we both drove here. You know, you came a long way. What do you want to get?
Yeah. I mean, I came here. Well, one, I want to do a lot more in-person things. So, you know, obviously I got the podcast. I like to interact with people, but I mean, I think a lot of it is like the relationships, just networking, just kind of, you know, hanging out with people, getting immersed in the, you know, Canadian culture, just kind of like, I mean, like I've talking with you, Joey, for what now? Like, at least almost 2 years.
Couple years. Yeah, we just met.
Yeah, and like today is the first time
in person.
Yeah, first time in person. But like I've known you and talked to you like almost daily now for like at least like a year and a half.
Yeah, been a long time.
Yeah. And so like I hear a lot about Canada. I wanted to know a little bit more about, you know, the culture and everything like that, because I hear about the economy from you guys. And like one thing I can say right off the bat is like
everyone's smoking dope outside this building.
It does smell like the devil's lettuce, like basically anywhere you go. Yeah. But I mean, like Canadians are extremely prideful, man. And like that is one thing that I think that we've lost in America is that everybody in America, like if you go to like I compare Toronto to like a mini New York City. If you go and ask anybody in New York City how they feel about America, they're like, I'm a New Yorker, I'm not an American. That's their kind of thing. But here it's like, you know, Canadians love Canada and they'll admit, you know, hey, it's got faults or whatever, but I love Canada. I love it for XYZ reason, my family, the beauty of it, all this kind of stuff. And they hold that true. And like, that's even true of Canadians that I've met in the States who are like, I want to go back. Man. And I'm like, why would you ever want to do that? I don't know. It's just giving you guys a hard time.
Mark, you know, I'm not really the guy to answer this question, but I'll ask it of Mark. You know, you own a business, you could take off. You don't, you know, why not?
Well, for one thing, my wife will not leave with me. So okay. She's an immigrant. She loves it here. Yeah. She loves Canada. I love Canada too. I mean, hell, I can get on a plane, I can fly thousands of miles, I can be on the other side of the country, and I'm like, I'm in the same country, right? And maybe the headspace is different, maybe the culture is different, maybe the things are different, but it's all Canada. And my friends and I used to talk about this when we were growing up, about the difference between the Canadian mosaic versus the American melting pot. Right. So the American melting pot was like, fuck your culture, you're an American, right? And that was supposed to be the mentality. Whereas here, it was multiculturalism that was always like official state edict. And for me, what sums up Canada the most, and I can't remember his name, so I'm about to butcher it, but the Sikh guy who came here and fell in love with hockey and did his own hockey night in Canada in Punjabi.
Yeah, yeah.
And he was before he was flying across the country on his own
dime. Do you know what hockey night in Canada is? For the American
listeners? I don't know.
It's so, the Saturday night.
Like every Canadian Canada.
It's on the state broadcast network. Yes. It's on the CBC.
It's hockey night.
They play NHL games, yeah.
And so there's this guy
So what's special about this day? Is it like the first Saturday? Is it something?
It's
like
every Saturday.
Every Saturday.
Every Saturday during the season. It's hockey night in Canada.
Oh, just every Saturday?
What day is it? It's hockey night in Canada.
That's right.
So, but this guy...
I'm like looking for it to be like MLB opening day. No, you know,
it's every Saturday.
It's just Saturday
all season.
But the point of this guy was he's wearing his turban.
Yeah.
He's wearing his traditional garb. He's got a suit on and a tie. And he's doing the play-by-play in
Hindi or
Punjabi or whatever it is.
Yeah.
And he's totally into it. And he's over the top. And I'm like, that is Canada.
Yeah.
Because it's like... That's to me the multiculturalism of Canada. And so where are we today? I don't know. It seems like it's polarized, but when you meet people on the street, they're not really going to ask you like, they're just going to deal with you as a person rather than like, well, I think you might be a Trump voter. So
that's right.
I'm not going to help you change the tire on your car. Like, it's not that polarized. No. Whereas in the States, it's like, you can't eat in this restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
Right. It's not like that here. There's this basic civility that has so far preserved all the way through.
Yeah.
But, and is that, you know, can you attribute that to the multicultural mindset, to the mosaic mindset versus the melting pot mindset? I don't know. But so I'm still here in Canada because I just, you know, for one thing, like there's this base layer of infrastructure and stability that we take for granted that you go to other countries in the world and you go, oh my God. Mm-hmm. Right. So as much as you complain about Canada and you get back here and you're like, okay, you know what? This system is hanging together pretty well. Maybe not like a Switzerland where they really have their act together, but there's this base layer of civility, infrastructure, decorum that you can rely on to a large extent.
Agreed.
And I, you know, I would love the country to hold together. I would love, you know, Wexit to not happen and Quebec to stay in and a complete change from how I thought about this 20 years ago. I actually think deeper integration with the U.S. would be possibly a calming effect across all of North America, because we are essentially very similar culturally.
For sure.
It's like there's more overlap in the Venn diagram than separation. And so that whole border thing, like I can't get Google barred because I'm in Canada. Like, come on, man, this is kind of ridiculous. Like, why don't we start dismantling a lot of those sort of artificial barriers and just say, like, let's just, you know, interact and be a normal society.
We are, you know, monocultural with the U.S. in so many ways. It's weird because, you know, if you've ever seen this population graph for Canada, everyone talks about how Canada is looking to be its own country. You know, it's not USA's little brother. But if you look at the population, 95% of it is within, you know, 100 kilometers of the border.
Yeah.
There's no one living above 100. It's all empty. Just trees.
It's just little women in like southwestern Ontario, Quebec, and Vancouver. And like, and how many Canadian families do not have a U.S. relative?
Yeah, I know.
Zero.
I know.
Yeah. Zero families in Canada do not have a U.S. relative.
That's right. You go see NFL games, you follow NFL teams, you follow all this stuff. You know, we've become so synonymous in a lot of ways with
the United States. The NBA, the NHL, like, I mean, we have there's teams, MLB, there's teams in Canada, right? I mean, we were talking about a little bit pre-show, like the Tampa Bay Rays where I'm at are talking about maybe coming back to Montreal. Like, I mean, there's like that cross-cultural, like with sports and everything else. I mean, it doesn't feel like I've been to a few other countries, and when you go there, you can definitely tell you're in another country.
Right.
Like, there's just small intricacies here where I've noticed just because I'm trying to observe them. But if I was just walking around, I'd feel like I'm in another big U.S. city.
Yeah.
You know,
we don't like that. I think a lot of Canadians don't like that. Like, Toronto is like just another big city, but there's places you can go, man. Like, I personally would suggest like Dundas, Ontario. My wife is from there. We're moving there.
Oh, that's where you're moving?
Yeah.
Nice.
That's
transition town.
What do they say? It's all newlyweds and nearly deads over there. So it's going to be pretty quiet, I think. But like that's an example of a small town. Even up where you are, Mark, over in
Etobicoke,
Cobourg, like the further you go that way, you see small town communities that have unique, you know.
Yeah, but you know, that's everywhere, man.
And stuff like that. I know, and it's nice. I'm saying that this is something that we share, and too many people are worried about. We don't want to be like Canada. We don't want to be like the States. We don't want to be like Toronto. You're more like each other than you think.
Oh, 100%.
You're more like each other than you think, you know, regardless of where you end up.
Yeah.
So
that's not a bad thing, really.
No, it's a good thing. So. It's a good thing. Yeah. Good for everything.
Yeah.
You want to wrap up with closing words?
Yeah, sure. I mean, thank you guys for joining me here and Joey giving me your setup and hijacking my show. But, you know, Mark, I guess, why don't you tell people where they can find you and what you got going on?
Sure. EasyDNS.com is the main gig, and bombthrower.com is where I rant incessantly about things I have no power over.
What about the Twitter handle?
Oh, Stunt Pope on Twitter, Bombthrower on Noster.
Okay, there we go. Awesome. Cool. All right, Joey, why don't you tell us where they can find you?
CBP or Joey Tweets on Twitter. And I think I'm – what's my Noster handle? Joey, but it's at Canadian
Bitcoiners.com.
Yeah. There you go.
Joey tweets with an extra E.
You sign off, I'll get ready to hit that.
Yeah, thing. Yeah. All right, everybody go subscribe to my YouTube channel, Green Candle. I'm trying to get to 800 before the end of the weekend. And yeah, there we go.